Hello and welcome to Catalyst and Witness, the podcast devoted to personal explorations at the New York Film Festival, hosted as always by myself, Ryan Swen, and this is the third and final festival dispatch for the 2019 New York Film Festival, and the second roundtable discussion of the basically the second half of the festival and the numerous things that showed within. And as with last week, I'm very happy to have a roundtable of guests, far-flung correspondents to join me. And it consists of...
Hello, my name is Graham Carter. I'm a filmmaker and I work at Metrograph, which is a movie theater in New York. Thank you so much, Ryan, for having me on the podcast.
I'm Beatrice Loiza. I'm a film writer. You can find my writings on the AV Club, MUBI, Brooklyn Rail, some other places. And this is actually my first time attending New York Film Festival. I was part of the Critics Academy this year.
I'm Dan Schindel. I'm associate editor at Hyperallergic, and this is my first year attending NYFF.
Great. Thank you all for joining me. Yeah, we're recording on the day technically that closes the New York Film Festival 2 days after closing night. And so we have a bit of a smaller panel and it's probably a smaller selection of films that we'll talk about, but I'm very excited to hear all of your thoughts on these. I think it might be nice to start out with Pedro Costa's Vitalina Varela, which won the Golden Leopard at Locarno and serves as sort of a follow-up in certain ways to 2014's Horse Money, his previous film. Dan, would you like to take this?
So there's a scene in Horse Money where the protagonist Ventura encounters this woman, Vitalina Varela, who has arrived newly in Lisbon because her husband died. And her husband's been there for a while, and like there's been this continual idea that she would move in, but it hasn't happened. And now it's finally happened, but he's died. So basically, Vitalina Varela, the film, takes place from her perspective, beginning with when she arrives in Lisbon, and then follows her essentially like piecing together like the kind of life her husband was leading here, like this sort of marginalized life as an immigrant in the city. And so it's if you know Costa, then you know like what to expect here at this point. You have these astonishing chiaroscuro compositions that are just ridiculous to look at. They're so painterly, but like he does them all on digital with like mirrors for lighting. It's an unmistakable style, and it collapses like both memory and memory and conversation and imagination and what's happening currently into this sort of hard to differentiate state, which is also a very singular style that he's developed with his more recent films. It's incredible to look at. It's an unmatched experience, like actually sit through. You know, Costa is like guys hardcore partisans within like the people who actually are familiar with his work, and I'm not as familiar with it, but like I've seen this in Horse Money, it was more recent films, and I count myself a very big fan of what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also saw it, and this was actually my first Pedro Costa, but like a week after I went and I saw Vanda's Room.
Vanda's Room.
Which I think I preferred. I don't know, maybe because I sort of understood what I was getting into at that point. But it's bizarre to be introduced to someone whose work, like I felt like I had never seen anything like it when I first watched it at TIFF. Actually, and it's really brilliant how mesmerizing his tedium is. I mean, like, it was halfway through, I was like, oh my god, like, my sense of time was entirely off because, oh man, it's just one of those films that immediately demands a rewatch, and I am sad that I wasn't able to see it again when I had the opportunity at NIFF, but don't really know what to say beyond. I was pretty struck by it.
His movies feel longer than they are, and like with him, he's the only person that I'll say that as a compliment with.
Right.
yeah. And his movies are already long. Like, I know In Vanda's Room is like 3 hours. This one is like almost 2.5. And you feel it, but like, it's such a like hypnotic experience. You feel like you're dreaming when you do it. Like, if you doze off and you wake back up, you don't know where you are. But like, if you had stayed awake, you might not be any more like oriented as to what's going on. It does take like, and it's not like inscrutable per se. It's just like, you just have to think your way through like what it means like to the characters, you know, because it's very much inside Vitalina's head. And she, I think there's this idea like that she even might not know exactly what she's thinking or dealing with her conflicting feelings. So like, it puts us inside her headspace brilliantly.
Graham, you also saw it, right?
I did. And obviously I'm alone in this in like a broader context as well, not just the podcast, but it was probably my least favorite Costa that I've seen. To me, it felt very straightforward in his, it lost a lot of the kind of like mystery that Horse Money had for me. It felt like the logical next step to Horse Money, which for me, like, Costa has never sort of not surprised me, I guess. So I was a little bummed out when I saw it that it was not necessarily, you know, and he sort of said it in the Q&A after that he just sort of likes this way of working. He wanted to get to know Vitalina better, which I can appreciate, but at the same time, I didn't necessarily think it felt like a step forward for him. There were a few things that totally blew me away, particularly when she goes up on her roof to kind of like see how bad the damage is, which is like entirely green screen. And like, I felt like this one was much more effect heavy than his other ones. Like, ever since I read about Diamantino, the guys who made Diamantino were like, oh yeah, we use the same effects company that Pedro Costa uses. It sort of made me rethink a lot of how he uses effects and stuff. So I was very conscious of that while I was watching this one. And I was, you know, super impressed by it. Obviously the visuals are incredible. There's like not a wasted shot in the whole movie. It's gorgeous, but I felt like it was missing a lot of the like tension that sort of like undergirds a lot of his other movies for me. But obviously like I have no ill will towards him as a filmmaker. I think he's great, and I'm happy that other people are enjoying it.
At TIFF, I was at his Q&A at a public screening, and he was so severe. He almost refused to talk about the film. He just like went on about the state of the film industry and how only now has he got, you know, some extra funding to like kind of do with what he wants after the Golden, what is it, Leopard?
Yeah.
Yeah, Golden Leopard.
But he just went on and on about like the state of the film industry and just how miserable it is for like real filmmakers. It was just so bleak. And then later that week, he was at the screening for Liberté. And while Abbas Serra was, I don't know, he's a really just kind of wacky character, but when he was doing his intro, Pedro Costa was just on his cell phone the whole time, not cracking a single smile, even though it was like full of quips. And he was just like on his phone literally until like the movie started. It was just, I don't know, funny to observe that.
Yeah, the Albert Serra Q&A was definitely like a highlight.
I'm curious about in Vitalina Varela, because Horse Money Falls is very, like, I hesitate to say fully like non-linear, but definitely much more internal, much more dictated by Ventura's mind, sort of progression, if you can say that it has a concrete narrative in that way. So how does Vitalina Varela, does it follow largely in that same?
Sort of. So in Horse Money, it feels like very internal. Like you could interpret it as like entirely taking place inside Ventura's head. With this, it's more like her mindscape is sort of bleeding into the real world. Because, like, you know, Horse Money mostly takes place inside this environment that seems like a prison or a hospital or a generally bureaucratic setting. Whereas here, like Vitalina is more of along like town and these alleys and these more real world, quote unquote, real locations. And so, but like as she's doing this, yeah, there are like characters who might be like, you know, memories intruding basically into the space, or like she's talking to her husband, who like is sometimes a sort of ghost-ish presence. Sometimes like something is physically present, sometimes not. So it's of a kind, but like a different way to show that. It is, I think that the way that comes out is like less like directly internal than Horse Money, but yeah, it certainly results in different experience.
And would you say like the direction is pretty consistent with the one with what he's developed, or is there like with Graham, what you said in terms of the effects, does it feel different in some tangible way?
Well, for me, I felt like it didn't feel different enough, I guess. I thought it was pretty linear compared to Horse Money. I don't know. I'll be interested to hear what you think about it.
Yeah, definitely. I like the only Costa I've seen is Horse Money, which I do really adore. But I'm definitely looking forward to seeing the other ones and seeing how this turns out. To move to another film that sort of took off toward in this fall festival circuit, Martin Eden, directed by Pietro Marcello, who had his sort of breakout with the sort of semi-fictional, semi-documentary Lost and Beautiful in 2015. And this is the adaptation of the Jack London novel. Beatrice, would you like to take the lead?
Sure. So like you said, it's adapted from the Jack London novel of the same name, but it's takes to the Italian coasts as opposed to San Francisco. So it follows Martin Eden. He's like this sort of uneducated sailor, and he meets this sort of woman that belongs to high society, who he falls in love with, and she falls in love with him back, who sort of inspires him to want to seek out an education and pursue writing, which he does, and contrary to expectation, he does successfully. And so the film is set sort of vaguely around, I guess, what is it, World War II? World War I? I don't know. I feel like the time was kind of... It's like,
very vague.
Yeah, it's very vague about the time period. But I think that is to its... I think it works. But anyways, there's, you know, eventually a jump in time and you see what he's... the state he's sort of in once he's found success and wealth as this very politically assailant writer. So it's sort of like a moral tale in some respect. And it also sort of has, it like has chopped up archival footage, which is an interesting element. But I mean, I really enjoyed it. At first, I was a little put off by its time jump, but I think, I don't know, there was something so earnest and like lush about its melodrama that really won me over ultimately. And it also didn't hurt that the lead, I forget the actor's name, is ridiculously good looking. So
Luca Marinelli.
Yeah.
I've heard already.
Yeah, I mean,
there's a lot of tweets.
Like that's kind of part of also like it's something that you acknowledge that everyone else in the movie recognizes, like, oh, this guy's pleasant to talk to and it's fine to talk to him even though he's like a peasant commoner because he's also kind of charming and good looking. Like we can keep him around. So that also like works in his benefit. I don't know. What did you guys think?
Yeah. It's funny. I don't know who tweeted this, but like my favorite summation is that it's about the struggle between socialism and being hot. I wasn't sure what to make of it at first. I've liked it more and more I think about it. It's an interesting spin on like this sort of very familiar arc of like this protagonist who struggles to like advance, and then once he does, it's like, oh, but it wasn't what he really needed all along, and his wealth has hollowed him out. But like, it's approaching that from actually a specifically more sort of politically astute idea, because like there's this running thread where like Martin Eden rejects the labor movement, socialism. He is a staunch anti-socialist stance. He likens it to slavery. He is as like incoherent on this as like basically any libertarian you'll read online. but like that is actually like a part of his arc. Like his individualism leads to nothing. It leaves him dissatisfied. It does not bring like the freedom that he thinks that it will. So that's a perspective on that familiar arc that we don't usually see. It's funny because like I looked this up and like apparently Jack London's original novel, like people did not glom onto that thread, the anti-individualist thing, which he like bemoaned at the time. And that's funny because like it was also something that I didn't immediately twig to while watching it.
Graham, you also saw it?
Yeah, I did. Sorry to sound like a hater, but yeah, I did not like that one. I felt like it was very straightforward, very simple. I feel like the narrative of like, you know, a guy finds fame and then it ruins him is like kind of standard. So it'd be nice to see something where it's like, you know, like Dan was saying, he is like a staunch anti-socialist, but he like feels like he's sort of like burning this new path or whatever, but obviously that's not the case, and he just kind of like ends in misery. I don't know. I didn't like the archival footage. I thought the archival footage felt cheap. The director was nice, though, at the Q&A.
I've heard people have very just like opposite opinions about the film, either like raves or just like, meh, whatever.
I read someone who had like an interesting read on like what the archival footage actually meant, but I don't remember who said it or what it was. I think it was Mark Ash, but I'm not sure. I gotta be clear. Like, I didn't love it. I just sort of, it's perfectly fine to me. Like, it did sort of improve from like sort of antipathy at first, because like I did like glom on more to like some of the stuff it was doing, but like overall, like it settles on like, well, that was, it could have done more, like Graham said. It would have been interesting to like, instead of skipping, I think, like maybe show like how his framework, his philosophy actually like fails him. That would have been interesting to see, I think.
I think it's interesting that it's like one of the European films in recent years that also relies on this time jump, you know, like Transit or like Happy as Lazzaro. But what distinguishes this from, I don't know, something like Petzold's super restrained filmmaking is it's so just unabashedly like sumptuous, and the storytelling is so romantic and kind of over the top. And I thought that sort of melodramatic dimension was kind of refreshing for a European cinema. I feel that lately has been, I don't know, just so into social realism and this restraint, as I said before. So I
agree. As far as like, I thought the interpersonal relationships in the film were really nice and kind of refreshing. I did kind of feel like the narrative failed the characters in some way.
I do find that really interesting. Of course, I've also read that some of the archival footage is shot, was shot by Marcello and purposely distressed or tampered with in order to look like something approximating the vague time period in which it takes place. So
I
follows
it
with
cheesy.
His more a documentary. fair enough. I'm curious to see like how that sort of that will play out, and it does seem like certainly one of the most discussed, most fascinating films of the year, so I'm very curious to see it. onto another film about dislocation of a certain kind is Kiyoshi Kurosawa's To the Ends of the Earth.
I missed that one.
about basically a Japanese travel TV host in Uzbekistan. Graham, do you want to take the lead on this?
Sure. I absolutely loved this movie. I thought it was it's my favorite thing I saw at the festival. I was bummed out by a lot of people's negative reactions. It's you know, kind of like what I was saying with like Martin Eden and Vitalina Varela. Neither of those films surprised me in any way, and like this did at every turn. It's like such a strange movie. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a travelogue. It's a musical. He was commissioned by Uzbekistan to make it. But in a lot of ways, I feel like it sort of tracks fairly well with his, you know, last few films. I don't think it was like totally out of left field for him. I don't know. It's so touching. It's like a beautiful, beautiful film. There's so much emotion in it. It's great.
I really, really like this movie. I mean, I'm generally in the camp for Kurosawa. I can't think of a movie I've seen from him that I didn't like. But yeah, I love like how he keeps like doing things in interesting directions. Like the fact that he turned this sort of offer from the Uzbek government into this kind of project, which is directly about like being an outsider, essentially. It was really just, like Graham says, it's like constantly surprising. And you know, it's often built into his films, like the sense of alienation. And that's obviously more acute here because it's about being a foreigner, being a tourist, being a visitor. And he makes such great use of these different spaces that you like can tell are like friendly spaces, but they're just so unfamiliar that in them, like the protagonist just feels completely lost. And her performance is extremely good as well. It's this great, like, if you've ever been like on your own in especially in a foreign country, but not even there, like in any unfamiliar locale, you'll like, she captures that sort of drifting uncertainty extremely, extremely well. Oh, kitty, sorry. yeah, your cat, Graham. So, and like, it's often really, yeah, it's often like really funny, like the way that she, especially her segments on like what looks like the world's just shittiest, lowest effort travel show. And that's also like a big part of it. Like, it's also exploring like his different ways to approach another country. And so, you know, there's a suggestion that if you try literally to do the travel show version of another country, it's not going to give you anything of substance. But even then, it like doesn't go for the easy answer, which we would expect to be like, oh, once she ventures out on her own and like has a more authentic experience, that'll work out for her. It's not that simple. It ultimately like tries to suggest that actually doing something worthwhile as a stranger in a strange land is a more slippery thing, and that connection is just like extremely hard to find. I really liked this.
Yeah, and I should just interject that the actress is Atsuko Maeda, who is a J-pop star, but also was the lead in Kurosawa's 2013,
Before We Vanish.
I think.
Yeah.
Not, I don't think, was
yeah.
she in Before We Vanish? Oh,
yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
But
and
also,
Seventh
yeah,
Code.
But also, in, yeah, Seventh Code is like 60-minute thriller sort of film. She was the lead in that. Yeah, I'm very curious about like this, like you were mentioning how it does like feel sort of in, I think one of you mentioned how it's sort of in this continuity of these films that he's been working with. Like, you do have certain films like Creepy in there, which are more what people expect from Kurosawa as a horror, filmmaker of a lot of horror, but he's also had Journey to the Shore from 2015, he had Before We Vanish, which are in much less conventional ways, especially like much less conventional sort of storytelling. Do you think this sort of continues that vein?
Yeah, I think it does. Like I said, it's a different spin on like his sort of excellent cinematography of alienation. I think that Journey to Shore actually is like a very good reference point for this. Similarly, like a travelogue. Similarly, like it's instead of this sense of like loss, it's this sense of displacements, personal displacement, I guess, is what you could look at it. And so, you know, he always pays really close attention to spaces, and here, like, the way that Maeda, like, travels through Eastern spaces, like, trying to seize onto something that, like, can make her feel safe in this different territory is really fascinating.
The remains we've seen, if this will get distribution, like, it's definitely been very spotty with even these NIF films, but I'm always very, very much interested in what Kurosawa has to offer. To move on to another film, very much centered around a performance is Sybil, directed by Justin Triet. And Beatrice, would you like to take this?
Sure. So Justin Triet, this is her second collaboration with Virginia Efira. She also was the lead in her very good In Bed with Victoria, which came out a few years ago,
yeah.
Which is also sort of like a multi-genre, but also fundamentally like a romance, sort of explores like the female psyche. But anyway, Sybil is also like that, but it follows the eponymous Sybil, who is a therapist who wants to quit therapy, or being a therapist, because she wants to pursue writing. So as she's trying to do that, she's like harassed by this woman named Margot, who's played by Adele Escharpopoulos, the blue is the warmest color woman. How do you say her last name?
I don't know personally.
Escharpopoulos? Like I don't
something
know.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. So she's harassed by this woman, Margot, who's an actress who's just a mess because she's in this love triangle with a fellow co-star whose partners with the director of their film, who's played by Sandra Hüller, and Margot gets pregnant. So there's like this whole mess that leaves Margot just mentally unstable. And Sybil steps in to help her, but she's also sort of parasitically using Margot's story to write her own novel. But Margot's drama also reminds her of her own sort of past romantic troubles with this boyfriend from like a decade back. There's like these parallels that show up. Related to just, you know, the strain of emotional dependence, the sort of gross, jealous moves that we play when we're trying to, you know, get the people we love to act the way we want them to act. But anyway, so as it's supposed to be sort of, I remember Tria explaining in the Q&A that it's supposed to be sort of like a cross between these two women. So Sybil becomes increasingly loses her shit. And Margot I guess, gets better. That's sort of like an abrupt thing where she does a time jump and she's ends up being the one that takes care of Sybil. But anyway, the film is very, there's so many elements to it. There's like also sort of some parts of that sort of interrogate bad mothers. It's just like the burden of being a mother if you're a woman that isn't necessarily like interested in mothering. There's also, you know, questions of professional ethics, plagiarism, that are kind of shoehorned in for me. But the film also just has a complex structure because it, you know, goes through this story, but it also just like is intercut with flashbacks to Sybil's relationship from 10 years ago. And it's very jolting. Like, you kind of don't expect it. And it's like off-putting because she like kind of looks the same. But I don't know. So I ended up writing on this, and that piece is coming out later. So I ended up liking it more because I sort of was able to make sense of it by just thinking about it more. But I remember when I first came out, I was like, yeah, there's, like, it was very funny. Sandra Hüller is like a personal favorite. And for me, she like comedically sort of steals the show. So like I enjoyed it, but I felt like it was also kind of a mess. So what did you guys think?
I didn't see it. Good to see Adele getting work, I guess.
I really liked it a lot. I haven't seen any of her other films. After I saw this one, a few people were like messaging me on Twitter, like, "Oh, you have to see In Bed with Victoria," which I really want to see. And then the film she made before that one, I can't remember the name. But yeah, I thought Sybil was great. I thought it paid a lot of attention to the characters and allows for like a lot of quiet moments for like a psychological thriller, which I liked a lot. But yeah, I pretty much agree with everything Beatrice said about it. It's pretty fascinating. It's definitely one of the most interesting movies I saw at the festival for sure.
Yeah, I'm curious, especially since like there is this explicit film element, and you have if I'm not mistaken, the filming takes place on Stromboli's with Hüller as the director. So how do those scenes play, especially in relation to the rest of the film? But like, are they a significant portion or?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of like comedic high point of the film, because it has like all three of the, you know, main actresses working together, sort of. And yeah, there's, I think, so yeah, and it shows, you know, Sandra Hüller like filming these parts of like a romance between Adele and then this other guy, I forget his name, he's like a French actor, but there's like that tension because everyone is aware of the drama that's actually going on outside of the film shoot, and so it kind of sabotages the film in a way. And so Margot, Adele again, is increasingly reliant on Sybil to like stand in and communicate through Sybil, in order to achieve, you know, what the director wants out of the film. And it's kind of bizarre because it's sort of showing her being increasingly dependent on Sybil to like literally do anything. And that sort of plays into Sybil's past life, because Sybil used to be an alcoholic, and like part of the reason her old romance came apart is because she was an alcoholic and like was super dependent on her old boyfriend. And so this, I don't know, meta aspect just is too much for her to bear, essentially. There are some interesting choices to use raw footage, and I don't really want to spoil it because it's such a good scene. but yeah, I mean, I think those were some of the most interesting parts of the movie, the like film within the film. Yeah.
Graham, anything you want to add to that?
Nothing to add to that. Yeah, I mean, it's great. It's really, it's funny. It's got everything, you know?
It does, yeah.
It's kind of great, honestly. Like, I feel like I might have underrated it when I first saw it.
Yeah, that's how I felt. I actually ended up seeing it again because I did have to write on it. And the first time I was like, oh my God, my mind. There's like too much being thrown at me.
Does that one have distribution?
Yes, it does. They told me that it should come out around January, but I feel like these things always get pushed back.
I would love to see it again. Right. Yeah, it's really, it's great.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. On to another sort of emerging director, another director who's a favorite of many is Federico Vero, who had his breakout sort of last year with Belmonte, and he has his film this year, The Money Changer. Graham, would you like to take a look at this one?
I'm a big fan of his. Belmonte at the neighboring scenes, I believe. The neighboring scenes thing the Lincoln Center does was fabulous. Like one of my favorite movies of last year. The Money Changer, you know, has been kind of divisive, I guess, among people. One of my friends who saw it at TIFF was like, this was the worst film I saw at TIFF. And, you know, obviously I totally disagree. It is like a little more standard. I feel like this year at New York Film Festival, there's been quite a few directors who have kind of been throwing people off. Like, you know, the Asayas threw a lot of people off. The Depletion threw a lot of people off. And Money Changer as well, where it's like these filmmakers are seemingly doing something like much more standard than they have before. But The Money Changer is like definitely still just as weird as the other Belmonte films. It's Vero's first adaptation, so it is slightly more straightforward. There are still like, you know, sort of abstractions in the film, but overall, it's like a very linear narrative. It takes place from like the 50s to the 70s. The lead actor has a lot of things sort of like happen to him that we see, but the performance is so good. One of the things he talked about in the Q&A was that they gave the lead actor like fake teeth, and that sort of changed how, you know, Vero's and the actor saw the character. And it's sort of funny to see this guy who like, on the surface, feels very kind of clueless, having all these horrible things happen to him. But then there are these moments where we kind of see the person he actually is, where he's, you know, taking advantage of people or, you know, hurting people. There's this really great scene where someone like shoots a gun near the car that he and his wife are in, and he like jumps out the car and like leaves his wife to kind of like, you know, fend for herself. And then when he comes back into the car after the shooting is like, fine, they were okay. He's like, oh, you need better reflexes or what? You know, there's like a lot of stuff like that, like where we're like unexpectedly confronted with who the character actually is, because a lot of the movie is just sort of showing him reacting to things. I thought it was great. It's beautiful. The cinematographer and Vero's like wrote it together, and then you know, obviously super closely collaborated as far as like the visuals go. It definitely feels a little different than Belmonte, because Belmonte has these like super bright colors, like surrealist touches, and Money Changer feels much more of like a, like it's Uruguay's submission for the Oscars, and like that sort of makes sense, I guess. Like it feels like it could be like a bigger movie, but then my friend who saw it at TIFF said it felt like a beer commercial, so like I guess a lot of people think it's kind of cheap looking.
Yeah, it's basically, it's like Curb Your Enthusiasm as a crime movie. The protagonist is very much a Larry David type.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that like a similar duck to save his own skin thing happened at some point on the show.
Right.
But no, it's a very funny movie.
It is.
I liked it. I didn't love, but I did like it. I don't really have much more to say about it than that. It's just like, it's sort of a, it's interesting the way it approaches his character. Like, it doesn't really let you ever mistake him for, like, you know, any sympathetic crime protagonist. It's like constantly like, yeah, this guy's a piece of shit. But it's like, normally in a crime movie, if a guy's a piece of shit, he's like, you know, a murderer or something. But this guy's much more mundane, white-collar kind of piece of shit.
Right.
Yeah. And that is actually interesting. It's like, that's not a usual perspective we get on crime, that like most crime movies like are basically a very lowest rung like crime, or like their drug stuff. But you don't often see the sort of middle manager fraud kind of crime. So that is like one of the more interesting things about it to me. And in that like sense, like the fact that it is basically like Curb Your Enthusiasm makes perfect sense. It's like, it's that sort of banality of middle class evil, essentially.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is interesting, like, because I do quite like Belmonte, and I think in particular, it's one of probably the most beautiful digitally shot films I've seen easily this decade, probably. I'm curious about this sort of muted palette, this sort of, like, does it still feel expressive in that same way, or is it purposely like tamped down, I guess?
Well, I was kind of surprised, like, after watching the trailer that was on the, like, you know, New York Film Fest site. It definitely looks super muted compared to Belmonte, but there are a lot of scenes that have super expressive lighting in that kind of like brownish palette that it has. So it was definitely not as much of a departure as I was expecting. I think y'all already talked about The Day I Play Shen, so I guess we're not going to talk about it tonight, but like, it's sort of similar to that, where it's like, on the surface, it totally reads as a departure, but I think it's actually very, very close to what they've been doing the whole time.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm very interested to see, and we'll see if it gets distribution. Before we wrap up, are there any other films that any of you would especially like to shout out just briefly?
I'm sure you've already talked about them, but shout out First Cow, great movie. Mm-hmm. Parasite, great. I Was at Home, But, very interesting movie. Irishman, easy answer, but also very good. That's what I'd like to show. Oh, and there's a short called Topography of Memory, which is really, really good.
Yeah.
That's something I feel could show up on MUBI, like, in a year or two.
Mm-hmm. Beatrice?
Yeah. So the Ukrainian director, Sergei Loznitsa, who's very prolific, he did this movie called State Funeral about... That's essentially like using archival footage from Stalin's funeral. I mean, you can guess what it's about, but I thought it was mesmerizing and very creepy and very funny also. So I would recommend that one.
Mm-hmm. And Graham?
The one I want to shout out is Wasp Network. No one else liked that movie, but I loved it. I thought it was classic. Everyone go see it. It's the best Asayas film ever made.
Wow.
What?
Go see it.
Oh, goodness.
Jesus.
I think we won't have enough time to discuss that, but I'd love to hear your thoughts at a later time. And like, in general, just your thoughts just on the festival as a whole, starting with Graham. On the films that you saw, at least.
To be honest, you know, I love New York Film Festival. It was part of the reason why I wanted to move to New York. It's always exciting. I love that it's sort of like a best of the year festival. It's not necessarily like, you know, a world premiere festival. This year was like the least excited I was in a long time for like just this lineup. Obviously, I ended up loving things that I did not expect, particularly the Asayas. I'm not a fan of his, but I really like that. The Kurosawa was great. But overall, you know, it's just always fun. It's great to see people and go to Alice Tully and very glamorous, you know. And as per usual, I'm kind of a contrarian, I guess, and ended up not liking the stuff people liked and then liked the things I liked, whatever. But anyway, overall fun festival for sure.
Excellent. Beatrice?
Yeah, I mean, I had a great time. This, like I said, this was my first time there. And I had have been to TIFF a few times, and like, that's such a big glamorous festival, and here, it was very refreshing to just like, one, have the time to chat with people and hang out with people. It just felt, I don't know, comparatively down to earth, you know, compared to what I've been to. So, I mean, I really had fun and I want to go back again.
Excellent. Dan?
Yeah, this is a great first TIFF for me. It was pretty, because I was at TIFF, it was pretty relaxed. Like, I mostly was using it to play catch up on films I didn't catch fair. I actually still, I have like a pile of screeners of stuff that was in projections that I have to watch. So like my experience for NYFF isn't technically over yet, especially since some of the stuff in that program seems really cool. But no, it was really great. It was cool to, I don't know, this is my first time. This, I'm not just like first at New York Film Festival, but like I'm living in New York now. So like it was cool to see people around and like get a feel for like the screenings and stuff. So yeah, for me, tip top experience.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you all so much for coming on this roundtable, and thank you to the listener for bearing with these recordings. As always, this was definitely shorter than the last one, but I think that we had plenty of very worthwhile things to say. So thank you all very much for coming on this roundtable.
It was great to talk to you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for putting up with me.
Of course. Thank you.